about fly fishing internet radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Jason Randall, and he'll be answering your most important questions on trout scents. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the internet. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded. We'll be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Jason Randall about trout scents. Whether fishing for trout in the Rocky Mountains, chasing silver salmon in Alaska, or jumping tarpon in the Florida Keys, the Platte River Fly Shop online store has all the top brands you need to gear up for your trip. We are Wyoming's largest Sims and Patagonia dealer, keeping a large variety of popular items in stock year-round. You might even find a great deal in our closeout section, from rods and reels to waders and boots. And if you're headed through Wyoming, make sure to put the Blue Ribbon North Platte River Tailwaters on your bucket list. Log in to WyomingFlyFishing.com today and check out their store, or give them a call at 307-237-5997. That's 307-237-5997 or WyomingFlyFishing.com. And chat with the experienced fly shop staff in their shop. But before we introduce Jason, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered for the drawing yet, you can do so now. Just go out to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Jason's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Jason's book, Trout Scents, courtesy of Stackpole Books. Here's how you can win. You got to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be something about Jason and I discussed during the next hour or so. And once we ask the question, you just need to submit your answer along with your name and location, the text box on our homepage, and the first person that gets the correct answer that does the submission correctly will win Jason's latest book called Trout Scents. So get ready, take notes, be ready at the end, and maybe you'll win that this great book. Our guest tonight is Jason Randall. Jason is a veterinarian certified in fish health and medicine. He is also a member of the World Aquatic Veterinarian Medical Association and the Society of Freshwater Science. He's been an outdoor writer for the last 10 years, with articles appearing regularly in American Angler, Eastern Fly Fishing, and many other outdoor magazines. His first book, Moving Water, A Fly Fisher's Guide to Currents, was released in 2012 by Stackpole, and it studies the effect of current on trout, their prey species and presentation, where the vertical layers of current create drag and requires adjustment to improve nymph fishing success. His second book, Feeding Time, A Fly Fisher's Guide to What, Where, and When Trout Eat, was released in August of 2013. He focuses on matching your fishing strategies to the trout's feeding strategies, especially when targeting large trout, because if you know the 5W questions for large trout feeding, who, what, when, where, and why, you can catch them regularly. His most recent book, Trout Sense, is now available and covers what trout see, hear, smell, and taste, as well as other senses only fish truly understand. And we'll talk a lot about that tonight. Well, Jason, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thanks, Roger. It's great to be back.
Yeah, so this is an intense book that you wrote.
It is. Yeah, it is. This completes the trilogy, which is, many people are referring to as kind of the textbooks of fly fishing. That's the Fly Fisher's Guide trilogy. And it is really not a light fireside read. These are books full of information, and they read much more like a textbook than a novel, for sure.
Yeah. And, I mean, you get in being a veterinarian, you get into the biology of all this and have a true understanding of all that. And, I looked at Geez, let me see. You spent a lot of time on wet trout season. See, I think we're at, just trying to look at the pages here. We're going from page 17 to 117, 118, 119 pages of just what the trout sees. So
it's a pretty hot topic. I mean, trout are visual predators. A lot of their decision making is based on what they see, and you know, I think there's a lot of new information in there that also discusses the search image, which is the criteria which trout use to select food, you know, the size, the shape, profile, color, those types of things, what's most important. And I think it really ties in very closely with fly selection, fly construction, and how we can fool more of them.
Exactly, and that's what we want to know how to do, is fool more of them. Well, there are things that you put in your book. There's, you know, we always, as humans, think of the five, as you put it, classic senses: vision, hearing, smell, taste, and touch. So how are what we know about sense, how does that differ from what trout have, and you know, what are the differences? I mean, how do we need to think differently about how trout sense things?
Well, they have very similar senses to ours, but they're much different in the way they operate and the information they provide to the trout. They don't have as highly developed a sense of touch as we have. You have fingers that require a lot of, you know, dexterity and fine control. Trout certainly don't have that highly developed a sense of touch. They have some other senses we don't have, the ability to detect magnetic fields. They found magnetite particles in the skulls of a lot of migratory salmonids that aid in migration, that help with geolocation. So they do have some senses we don't have. They have some very similar senses to ours, and some of them are certainly modified and adapted to the environment they live compared to above water environment that we live in.
And they also have some senses that we don't have, right?
Correct. Probably the most apparent would be the magnetic perception, the detection of magnetic field. I think that's probably the most novel sense that they have. Certainly some of their, like their sense of hearing is highly adapted to the underwater environment. They we don't have a lateral line the way they have, which is a very sensitive means of detection for pressure waves and those types of mechanical waves underwater, which aids in the schooling behavior of fish, and even like blind Mexican bat cave fish, they can navigate underwater without any visual information, strictly by the lateral line and the type of mechanical waves that they can detect underwater.
I don't know if I'd like to go around my whole life eating things I never see, you know?
No, I don't think so either. And, you know, the lateral line also aids trout in current because they can register the difference between one side of their body and the other, so they can position themselves ideally right at the break of current, you know, so they're just on the softwater side of the current, yet watching the food particles drift by in the faster water. So it does aid in feeding lives and holding in current, that type of thing, navigating in current.
Yeah, yeah. We got a question from Don Brannon in Villis, North Carolina, and it kind of gets into the philosophical aspect of what we're talking about. But I'm sure you have some input on this, being, you know, where you come from, your medical background with animals and so forth. He says, "We've heard that trout have an IQ of 6 because their brains are the size of a marble."
Let's hope that's not true. I hate to get beat by a trout with an IQ of 6.
Yeah. And I've heard more of the idea of a size of a pea, but I guess it depends on the size.
That's probably
of fish.
True.
But they also can discern things via lateral lines, etc. How do we know that they don't have distributed intelligence? How do we know that what intelligence entails for such a being? I would guess that a tree has its own kind of intelligence. Isn't this more a sign of how ignorant humans are than how stupid trout is?
Well, that says a lot.
Yeah.
I think that's more of a statement than a question, but yes, I think that's true. there is an innate sense of intelligence, I think, that is instilled in animals. You see it. How does a wild animal know to nurse their young? How does a salmon know how to, you know, to begin the migration? What innate imprinting exists then? And that's certainly a very real sense of intelligence. I think that is shared by all living species to some degree. I don't think we fully comprehend the extent of that. But then there's a lot of learned behaviors, too. Trout are certainly able to learn. That's been demonstrated by a lot of scientific research. Certainly, fly fishermen are aware of that. If you hook a fish a couple times, they seem to get educated. I think older fish tend to be a little more wary. And I think that we've proven that as anglers, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know there's been, and this is like a whole other discussion, but you know, when you talk about senses, you know, there's these whole discussions about whether trout, you know, or fish feel pain, you know, when they get hooked and things like that. So, you know, that's kind of another whole aspect of sense.
Yeah, that's true. And I think there's been a lot of investigation into the topic of pain in fish, and there's a lot of different studies. Sometimes they've been sponsored by humane societies, and they certainly come to one conclusion. And I think depending on who sponsors the study, oftentimes it kind of dictates the findings. But I think one of the most widely recognized independent study that was more of a scientific type of approach was the one that was done by a researcher named Rose. And the Rose report came out with the fact that fish do have receptors that detect noxious stimuli. They know, you know, if there's another fish that's bit at them or there's a heron that struck them and left a wound. They do react to noxious stimuli, but they lack a part of the brain that processes the stimuli and registers it as pain. So the current thinking now is that obviously they do have response to injurious stimuli, but they really don't have the highly developed pain perception that we would associate with pain.
Interesting. Yeah, and you know, you talk about what animals, you know, what their intelligence levels are and so forth and what they know or don't know. And I saw a really interesting video. I think somebody posted it on Facebook or something, but I think it was taking place in Africa. It looked like maybe some water buffalo. And a lion had brought down a buffalo. Mm-hmm. And the buffalo was still alive. It was on its knees, basically, on the ground, but moving its head about. And the lion was on the right side of this buffalo from the camera's point of view. And it's too far away, but it looks like he's, like, you know, maybe starting to feed on this buffalo that's still alive. So then these two other buffalo come in from the left side of the frame, walking towards this, you know, this downed buffalo. And one of them, with a rather nice rack on it, walks around, goes around, picks that lion up with its horns, and tosses it like 10, 15 feet in the air, and then drops it, and then does it again. And I think eventually, it's hard to tell from the video, but I think it probably killed the lion.
Wow.
But I thought that was very interesting because we think of, you know, like buffalo as, okay, they're herd animals, you know. Yeah, they might protect their young, you know, mm-hmm. if their young are being attacked. But this buffalo, on purpose, walked around the other side and picked that lion up and, you know, basically destroyed that lion because that lion had wounded one of its own. And I thought that was, you know, what's going on in that animal's mind, you know?
There's a lot of herd behaviors that I think, you know, can be explained biologically as, you know, trying to enhance or improve the survivability of the individual by improving the survivability of the herd or the strength of the herd. So I do think that clearly falls under that innate type of intelligence that animals seem to possess.
Yeah. Well, he was pissed off, whatever. That's the reason. He wasn't afraid of that lion, that's for sure, you know.
So, oh, yeah.
Well, anyway, enough of that. Another question came in. I've just kind of put this under the general sense thing because this kind of falls into the same area. Is Bryce out in Ogden, Utah, wrote in. He says, what do you think about fishing after a full moon? It seems like I never catch many fish on the days around a full moon. Any suggestions on how to make fish bite? This, to me, was another sense question, you know. How do fish sense, you know, barometric pressure, and how does it affect them? And I know this is maybe off the track of, you know, our general conversation, but
Well, no, I think I agree, and I think a lot of the guys I fish with also have come to the same conclusion that full moons can be a tough time to fish. And you think of something, you know, a strong gravitational pull of the moon that can move tides, what profound effects must it have on the organisms that live in the water? And fish are very pressure adapted. You have, you know, more shallow water fish and deeper water fish, and clearly there is going to be some influence through swim bladders and things like that and pressures. But I don't know that it's ever really been fully explained. I remember a fisherman that once told me he did not like to fish when the moon was overhead. He liked to fish when it was underfoot, meaning it either sat or it was not evident as a full moon. So I don't know that there is a real good scientific explanation for it, but I do feel that it's true.
Yeah, it seems to be something many fishermen have documented over the years.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think if you look at somebody's journals that they've kept, and you know, I've been blessed with the opportunity to have access to some of that data, and you can see a rise and fall in fish, you know, conditions and fish caught based on some of those cycles.
Yeah. Well, let's talk first about what fish see. What do they see under the water? And we'll get to above the water here in a minute, but they must have a pretty good vision for finding
the
midges that we throw at them. So.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, can you imagine, you know, having to sort through the milieu of material that's carried in the current and try to pick out your food particles from all of the rest of the debris that's floating? I was astounded the first time I went underwater with a camera and videoed and recorded just the amount of debris, the pieces of algae and the bits of organic material and the other just junk that's floating in the current. And how do they pick out their food particles from that? It's like, it'd be like trying to pick out a cheeseburger out of a tornado as the wind went by.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty astounding that they do that. They do have, their sense of vision is very adapted for underwater life. What they see, I think the best analogy to what their underwater visual world looks like is it would be like walking around in a room with a glass mirrored ceiling that has a skylight directly overhead. The mirrored ceiling would be the the reflection of the room that you would see if you looked up at an angle that does not allow for the transmission of light where you could see above. So it's like trout live in a room with a mirrored ceiling with a small skylight window that looks up into the world above.
Mm-hmm. Now, Peter wrote in from Edmonton, Alberta, you know, what impact should trout's ability to see light in the UV range have on fly selection and dyeing materials? Do trout lose UV vision capabilities after 2 years of age? You know, I extend that to how does that play with color in general, not only UV, but, just general color.
Well, color transmission underwater is highly variable, and different environments transmit different color ranges better than others. If you look at a marine environment where, you know, if you go underwater, you see primarily blues in open water, and everything has a bluish cast to it because that type of marine environment favors the transmission of blue light. If you look closer to shore in the ocean, you see a green kind of discoloration to the water. If you go underwater, everything appears green, and those are called color shifts. And so different ecosystems have a different transmission of light. They transmit a favored light range. Mostly in freshwater systems, it's kind of a yellow-brown transmission. So underwater, everything tends to have a yellow-brown color shift, and that really influences the color of anything that the trout would see. It's like looking at the world, but in this case they're kind of yellow-brown, so everything acquires that tint. So some lights, some colors underwater are more easily transmitted than others. Ultraviolet light is not very well transmitted in fresh water because it's way beyond the blue and violet range, whereas the favored colors for transmissions are more in the center part of the color spectrum, in the browns and yellows, kind of towards the other end a little bit. And so ultraviolet light is not well transmitted in freshwater. It's a little bit better in open marine environments. And trout really, I think, Peter really hits it on the head here where he says trout lose their ultraviolet capacity at a certain point in their age, and that's very true. For very young fish that are feeding on plankton, ultraviolet light sensitivity is very important for food discrimination. It kind of helps them pick out different plankton that I think they may favor over another. But by the time they've grown beyond a few inches in length, they've really shifted their diet more towards an invertebrate-based diet, and they lose the ability more or less to detect ultraviolet light. And there's been some controversy, even in the scientific world, maybe 10 years ago, they thought that ultraviolet light sensitivity was more important to trout. There were some conflicting studies back, you know, right around 2000 to 2005. But currently, the scientific community really feels that ultraviolet light does not play a really significant ecological role for trout. They have the same kind of color receptors that we have in our retina. They have cones and for color, and they have rods for low light types of situations. The cones have the same kind of red and blue and green color sensitivity that ours do. The interesting thing about really young trout is before they reach that point where they make that dietary shift, so when they're less than a couple of inches in length, their blue cones are actually more tuned to ultraviolet light detection. Once they reach that, about the smolt stage or about the par stage for freshwater trout, they lose the ability, most of the ability, to see ultraviolet light as those ultraviolet cones then shift to blue sensing cones. So I think Peter hits it right on the head. At some point in their life, usually around the smolt for migratory species or the par stage, you know, for stream residents, they do lose most of the detection ability for ultraviolet light. So I think the use of ultraviolet light materials is perhaps maybe a little overindulged, perhaps. Maybe
yeah.
The importance of ultraviolet has been overestimated. I do think some of that, and I had a lot of people send me ultraviolet materials and ultraviolet rinses and dips and things like that. And, you know, I really look at these products and I think trout really can't see ultraviolet light, or at least it isn't really a major role for them. But these products do have other characteristics that I think make them attractive to trout. I saw one product that was an ultraviolet light type of flying material, but it really had a natural iridescence to it. I think actually it's the iridescence that probably captures the trout's attention. Iridescence is kind of a shifting color, like kind of like a mallard duck's head. Sometimes at certain angles it looks green, sometimes it looks blue, sometimes it looks black. That's iridescence, and I think that gives a natural sense of movement, and I think that is probably what's selling the trout rather than any ultraviolet light characteristics that it may have.
Well, a lot of invertebrates have that, you know, insects have, you know, you look at beetles and stuff and they have iridescence,
yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah.
And
a mayfly's wings.
Yeah.
A mayfly's wings will have kind of a pearlescence type of thing. So there is a lot of that. It's a very natural phenomenon. And I think also there's a term that we use called chatoyance, where there's it's like a tiger eye effect. There's a, you know, you put like a tiger eye type of a product on a, like a Clouser minnow or something for the eyes, and it gives that eye that kind of, that shine that you see on trout's eyes underwater. And I think those things can be very attractive. I think ultraviolet light, currently the scientific community is really, thinks that it has little ecological significance to trout.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break here, Jason, and when we come back, we'll talk more about color because I've got some more questions for you. Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company is North Carolina's premier backcountry fly fishing guide service. Located in North Carolina at the base of the Blue Ridge Mountains, they fish some of the most beautiful limestone spring creeks North Carolina has to offer. Their guide has over 15 years of professional experience in the area. In addition to their backcountry guide service for experienced anglers, they offer intensive full-day instructional trips for the novice angler. So go spend a day with them in fly fishing paradise. For more information on their services, please visit www.nc-flyfishing.com. That's nc-flyfishing.com, or call them at 828-758-2446. That's 828-758-2446. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Jason Randall about Trout Sense. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Jason, I always ask my guests, you know, at this point in the show, what's going on in your fly fishing world. So I bet you're glad to have this number three done in your trilogy. That took a lot of work, I bet.
It really did. A ton of research. You can see in the back, I think it's 20 pages of references and credits. The amount of research that went into this book is much greater than either of the other two. So I'm enjoying a little bit of a break right now, and I still keep up with regular articles for American Angler and some of the other regional magazines and things like that. But it's been kind of a nice break, I got to admit. I'm spending a little more time fishing now.
Good, good. That's always important, right?
Yeah, I just got back from the Ruby River in Montana. We spent the last 2 weeks out there. Have you ever fished the Ruby?
No, no.
No, it's a beautiful river. We got a chance while we were out there to spend a day with Emma Kayer, who's the lead biologist on the Ruby River grayling reintroduction program that they've been trying to do over the last 10 or 12 years. And it was really exciting. We spent a day shocking the upper Ruby and taking data from the fish. We got a lot of rainbow trout and cutbows, and we did see a number of really nice, healthy grayling. And they've just done a really good job of bringing that species back into their native habitat. And we were able to tag some fish and record weights and some sizes. We got some of the grayling were between 13 and 14 inches, so it was a wonderful opportunity just to visit a very, very successful program that's been run by the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. So that was a tremendous opportunity. And if you ever get a chance to go, there's a good population of grayling up there, and it offers anglers the opportunity to catch the grayling in their original native habitat in Montana.
Yeah.
So pretty
yeah.
neat.
Yeah, they're fun. Yeah.
There's some neat people up there, too. One of the people we were staying with at Upper Canyon Outfitters, Jake and Donna McDonald, actually have been very involved in that, won an award from National Award Conservation type of recognition for their efforts on it. So that's been fun. We actually got to spend a little time fishing up there, too, and kind of caught the tail of the hopper season. So if anybody's looking for a chance to get some native grayling in the lower 48 states, that's a great opportunity.
Yeah, cool. Well, I'll have to talk with you later about that. That might make a show.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, more about color. Doug from Calgary, Alberta, wrote in on the internet here, and he wanted to know about trout's vision, ability to see colors. We're talking about that and peripheral vision, and he might speak to that as well. In colors, I noticed in your book you did a bunch of tests, and you have color photographs in there, both in ocean settings and also in freshwater settings. And it's very interesting, the colors that seem to stand out. It seems like that red-orange, more on the orange side than the red side, seems to stand out more in almost any water than any of the other colors, along with maybe yellow, Would you agree?
No, you're absolutely right. And that goes along with the color shift. And you can see in some of the photographs how well some of those fluorescent colors really show up and kind of across the board, as you indicated, in different water systems. So I think fluorescent colors are highly visible. And I think if you look, in the marine type of environment, the blues really show up, whereas the reds kind of, they're at the farthest end of the visual spectrum away from the blues. They kind of turn to a muddy brown, and then they kind of just all disappear more or less altogether.
Yeah, and it kind of makes you think, about, these little hot spots we sometimes tie into our fly and so forth that seem to make a difference, and those things I think could be very important in catching a fish's eye.
Oh, I agree completely. I think hot spots are a very effective way of capturing trout attention, because I think most of the prey species that they feed upon have contrast. Contrast is, look at the trout themselves. They have one color pattern on the top and a different underbelly, and insects the same way, and minnows. So I think contrast is... So sometimes we overlook that in our fly construction. If those hot spots, I think, accentuate contrast and maybe overemphasize it, but it is a very
big feature to trout.
Yeah, yeah. Randy Pitt wrote in and asked, he says, what color brand and material is best for trout fishing? I know a lot depends on hatches in the area, but without knowing the area, what are sure fly or spinner colors to use?
Well, I think it depends on water conditions. There are certain flies that I really, really like for certain conditions. I always like to try to match my fly with the trout would potentially be seeing as a food source, and that changes from season to season. In the winter, I think the invertebrate drift is more skewed towards midges and scuds. I think the larger insects are more dormant during the winter. So I think my winter fly selection, especially if the water is, you know, you're starting to see some melt off and heavy flows, I think I might use a scud with a really bright fluorescent hot spot on it so that it's very visible in the stained water. If it's a summer rain and there's a lot of brown water and heavy flows, I might use a San Juan worm that has more of a earth tone main color, and then maybe a bright hot spot of fluorescent pink or something like that. And there's a fly I really like that Ben Ferimsky's Gunny Special is a kind of a woolly bugger streamer kind of a fly that has a very dark basic color, earth tone color, black, dark brown, and a very fluorescent kind of green contrasting color. I think works really well, you know, like some kind of a green color shift where there may be a lot of algae in the water, where you're fishing a pond or something like that where there's a green color shift.
Speaking of algae, Lanford from Castle Rock, Colorado, wrote in here on the Internet. He says, whenever I pump a fish's stomach, trout, it appears to be 90% algae that are apparently picking up incidentally when feeding on other things. But if you have the least bit of algae on your fly, you're wasting your time. Why is that?
You know, that I think is an excellent question that I think mystifies most of us. But trout do oftentimes grab vegetative material in with their food bits. And again, I think that goes back to trying to snag a cheeseburger with your mouth or catch a piece of popcorn in your mouth that's whisking by in a monsoon type of wind. I mean, it's got to be hard to discern the edible from the inedible. I know they make a lot of mistakes along the way. But I think trout also tend to, you know, like there's small crustaceans that are in, you know, beds of watercress and algae that and scuds. They'll just grab that and they'll get the bug in with the algae. So sometimes when we're pumping the stomachs and things like that, we'll see algae, but it was really inadvertent consumption where they just knew there was crust bugs or something in there as well, and they just gobbled up a mat of vegetation. And some of it, too, is digestible. They may be able to get some benefit. I know at one point in the life, trout are vegetarians. They eat mostly plankton and small particles like that, small bits of algae.
Yeah, it's, you know, Lanford is probably the same reason that trout hit my indicator. And
that's true.
And then I put a hopper on there, they don't hit it, but they like the indicator. You know?
If you could put a hook in your indicator, you'd probably catch some fish, right?
Yeah, oh, exactly. I mean, we've all had that happen. You know?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, that's the new invention. Somebody's got to come out with the indicator attractor fly.
Yeah, that's it. It would be hard to cast.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a great question. Yeah, it's fun to talk about that stuff. Another question came in from Ray in Montana. He says, is your leader more visible to trout if it has floatants such as gink on it? Were you able to observe any leader?
Yeah, some of the photos we have when we were doing underwater photography, sometimes a leader is highly visible. And I think the closer it matches the density and optic characteristics of water, the more it tends to disappear in water. The index of refraction, you know, from a scientific term. And I think fluorocarbon has a closer number to water than does monofilament. And so I think that's been one of the selling points of fluorocarbon. But, yeah, I think if you put a wetting agent on it, something that is hydrophilic, meaning that it tends to attract water, I think it does help it disappear. I don't know that it's not anything that I've really paid close attention to, you know, different products on the line, but clearly you can see the line underwater, especially floating line as you're looking up. when it dimples the mirrored surface of the trout's upward view, it's highly visible. When it's in the transparent part of the window, what's called Snell's window, where they look up into and they can see the sky directly overhead, the line is a little less visible there. So it definitely makes more of an impression when it's dimpling the surface of the mirrored part of the water surface.
Roger Campbell in Cheyenne, Wyoming, asked, he says, regarding what trout see, what order of importance for fly tires would you give to the following: color, shape, size, body texture, i.e. smooth, shaggy, rough? What do you think about that?
Well, it really opens up that whole concept of search image. And a researcher back in the 60s developed the concept of search image. The researcher's name was Tin Bergen, and he looked at songbirds and how they discriminate their prey species, like moths that tend to disappear on the bark of a tree. Their color and camouflage is so closely matching the tree bark that they can't hardly be seen. But how do the moths then successfully forage on those prey species when you can hardly see them? So they came up with a concept of search image. What is kind of a checklist then that predators go through in order to make a prey selection? So they, and size and shape are certainly very, very important, especially at a distance. And if you think of a game my brother and I used to play when we were traveling on long road trips, was we would try to pick out different kinds of cars from a distance. And we were looking for Corvettes back then because every six-year-old kid wanted to have a Corvette back in the 60s when we grew up. So we were always looking for, you know, the sports cars. And the thing that was most recognizable from a distance, probably the first thing that you could tell, was the size. You could certainly tell a van from a car. You couldn't see the color always. You couldn't tell green, dark green from dark purple from black at that distance. But you could see size. And the next thing that was probably apparent was shape. And then finally, as the car got closer, you could see the color and make more determination of detail, perhaps. So and the same is true of trout. As they look at a potential prey meal, as it approaches them in the current, the thing they first see is probably size. And then the second image selection criteria would be shape. And then as they get closer, it's probably going to be color, because the color is certainly not going to be accurate at a distance because of color shifts, but the closer they are to it, the more true the color will be represented. And then probably one of the most overlooked feature of the search image is animation. Does it look and act and behave as a living prey species should? Does it have rubber legs that wiggle like a grasshopper would, or does it have an undulated movement like a leech or something like that? So I think animation is equally important, and that goes back to how are we fishing these things. And so when you look at animation, a sculpin, perhaps one of the mainstays of larger trout diet, swims much differently than maybe a small minnow or a darter might or a dace or even a trout parr. You know, a sculpin doesn't have a swim bladder, so they sink, and so they swim with up and down types of movement. So I think if we're going to put a sculpin on, we should try to make that sculpin swim like a natural sculpin. That streamer should behave the way a natural sculpin would, which is sometimes it drops to the bottom and just rests on the bottom, and then it kind of pulses and swims up, and then it floats back down again. So I think animation is one of those things we often overlook. We want to make sure that we're adding the correct animation to imitate the prey species that our fly is supposed to represent. But I think from a tire standpoint, I think the size and the shape are probably the most important criteria to get those right. And again, it depends on the circumstances under which you're going to fish them. Trout don't see color at night. So I think color is much less important for night fishing than it might be for daylight fishing, because during the evening, they don't use the cones, which are the color receptors in the retina. They actually pull those out like unplugging a TV or something. They just pull those back, and they're not used at night. And the rods, which are much more light sensitive and give them tremendous visual acuity at night, those are engaged. And so, but the rods don't detect color, so trout can't see color at night. So they see shade, but no color.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. you know, when you talked about search image, it reminds me of, you know, we as humans have those two. May not be in the after prey, but you talked about cars, and it's every time, you know, you're going to buy a new car, you know, you kind of zero in on a make and model and so forth, and then you start seeing those cars everywhere. And then you buy the car, and you even see more of them, and you didn't realize there were so many of those cars around, and you thought maybe you only had the only one, you know, and then everybody's got that car, you know. And it's kind of that search image, too. You implant that image on your brain, and then that's what you tend to see all the time.
You've raised an excellent point, because the search image is stronger the more repetitions that it experiences. So, perfect segue into this topic of selective and opportunistic feeding, because the more times that a trout sees a certain prey species, the stronger that search image becomes. And then the more discriminant they are, that, you know, where they want something to be a closer match to that search image, the search image is reinforced with you know, successful prey encounters. The more they feed on that prey and have success, then the stronger that search image becomes. It's just like, you know, like you just said.
Yeah, very interesting. Because, you know, probably a lot of the things we do we don't think about, but go back to, you know, our caveman days. And as humans, we have a lot of these same things going on. We just don't recognize them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right. I was just out dove hunting recently, and when I first started in the day, you know, I could not see it. You know, that's a killdeer or that's a sparrow or something like that. But by the time we had hunted for 2 hours, I was getting pretty accurate then, even from a distance, of picking out the dove. And again, it's because of the repetition factor.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll dig more into what trout see. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. It's www.frontrangeanglers.com. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Jason Randall about Trout Sense. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer it on the show tonight. Okay, Jason. So let's, anything else you want to add before we shift to what trout see on or above the water, to things as fly fishers we, you know, we need to be tuned into under the water?
Well, you know, I think their vision in a linear way is very similar to ours. I mean, when they're looking straight, I think they're going to see other fish. When they're looking up at an angle, they're going to see the reflection of the bottom, just like that mirrored ceiling. And then when they look straight up is the only opportunity they have then, and it goes into a lot of physics and angles of incidence and things like that. But that's where their window would be then to the world above. And so I think trout truly do live in a room with a glass mirrored with a movable skylight that follows them around that's directly overhead, and that's the only portal they have then to the upper world.
Okay. So let's talk about that and what they can and can't see. You know, it's been described, and we've talked about this before, that window. How does that window change depending on where the trout is, and how do we need to deal with that window in that, you know, trout can see us? So what's the best way to approach all that?
Well, I think rather than a window, it's more accurately described as like a fisheye camera lens that collects lights from multiple different angles, not the full 180-degree spectrum that would go from horizon to horizon, but probably they have a 10% dropout on either side so that their spectrum of vision above is closer to 160. But it's like having a fisheye lens up there, a wide-angle lens, so they can literally see almost around corners, if you will, so they can see it'd be like in a swimming pool and they were 6 feet deep up against the wall or close to the wall, they could still see kind of over and around the rim of the pool. So there's a lot of unique visual features, I think, that happens because of the physics of water and air.
Yeah, and I notice I'm looking at one of your pictures in your book. It's on page 64, I think, where you've got a fisherman on the bank, and the fish is in the water up against the bank, kind of, and the vision that you've drawn for the fish is bending to where maybe the angler can't even see the fish, but the fish can see the angler. Is that true? Am I reading that right?
Correct. There could be an interruption in the direct line between the fish and the angler, but because of the bending of light, it gives them that more or less the ability to see around corners and over and above the rim of the bank. So it's like they have a fisheye lens and they can see a wide field of almost horizon to horizon above the water.
So as fly fishers on our approaches, I'm reading what you're saying is we need to even be more careful than maybe we normally are.
I think it depends on the conditions and water clarity. And don't forget, too, that we're looking at kind of an artificial scenario here because the surface of the water, especially in rivers and streams, is never perfectly flat. It's always going to be broken by choppiness or waves or surface activity. So I think that that has to be taken into account. So I don't think that they have a perfect television-like view that really can look around corners as accurately. There's a lot of distortion that goes into that as well. So I do think that, under most conditions that trout have a pretty accurate view of what's happening above water, though, even though there is distortion, even though there is some surface choppiness to the water oftentimes. So I do think we need to bear that in mind. I think coming in with a lower approach for spooky fish is advisable, and I think also slower. Don't forget, one of that search image criteria for predators is movement and animation. So I think that certainly can be part of their alert mechanism as well. That sends them fleeing if there's a sudden movement or something like that. Think of like going back to that lion in the water buffalo, as they select a prey species as a mountain lion hunts a deer, it might be the flick of a tail or the twitch of an ear or something that attracts the attention. I think the same goes for trout as prey as well. They're very wary of movement. So I think if we can approach low and slow, I think the old wisdom of anglers is probably still pretty relevant.
Yeah. But, yeah, I can see how, as we get a little ripple on the water, whether it's in a stream or on a lake, that, that's going to definitely disrupt their clearest vision.
Yeah, if you look at some of the pictures that we show in, I think it's in the color section of the book, you can see the effect of the ripples when you look at the amount of distortion, especially at the edge of the window where there's a lot of compression of the image because of the bending of light. You can see where just a little bit of ripple on the water really, really breaks up and distorts the image so that sometimes it's very not recognizable necessarily as an angler, but the movement is still something that really focuses their attention and alert them. So I think maybe the fact if we were just standing still, we wouldn't be recognized as an angler or a threat to the trout. But once you start waving a rod up in the air, I think that it becomes a very threatening type of movement. It's very, very much noticed, I think, by fish.
Well, and even we notice that. I mean, we notice, if you're out walking outside and, a bird flies over our head, I notice the shadow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
absolutely.
Bird shadow. It's not. I'm not threatened by it, but I'm not normally threatened by birds. but the trout would be, and it's that you don't even know what it is. You don't know where it is, but the movement, the shadow,
right,
catches your eye. And I'm sure that they tune into a lot of that movement.
Oh, that's a good point too, especially since one of the major threats that they face throughout their life is overhead predation, herons and birds of prey, and so I think they're very aware of that type of threat.
Mm-hmm. We had a question, and this is, I put it in the section under what trout see here, but Richard in Walla Walla, Washington wrote in. He says, Jason, do you agree with several other guests speaking on Ask About Fly Fishing that trout are more likely to strike a two-fly rig than a single-fly setup? And I think he's referring to not a hopper-dropper, you know, kind of situation, but two nymphs, you know, floating in tandem down the stream. He says, if yes, do you have a theory on why trout react this way?
Well, I don't know. I think it, just from the law of averages, I think it doubles your chances. So I'd use it wherever it's legal, I know, and there are a few places that you have to use only single hooks. But wherever permissible, I usually do that as well. And I think maybe offers a trout a couple of different food selections. I usually use a small nymph and a larger nymph, or I might use, you know, a small ICU midge or a zebra midge and a larger nymph, like a prince nymph or something like that. And I think it just gives me more opportunity as a fisherman to catch fish. I think it helps me a little bit more focus in on what they might be accepting as a prey source. So I think it gives me a chance to maybe formulate those ideas a little quicker. If I notice they keep taking one fly, then I think it helps me target that a little closer. So I do it all the time as well, wherever I can. And I don't know really if it you know, I've heard some theories. I've even seen, you know, a lot of people that fish double streamers, and they think, well, it looks like one fish chasing another. And I'm not really sure how much of that may be actual or what our opinion might be, but I do think it works, and I fish it wherever I can.
Yeah. I'm not sure which Richard was referring to, because I've done so many shows and we've talked about so many things, but I seem to remember some time where, you know, the theory was that you've got two flies floating down, that maybe one catches the attention of the trout, mm-hmm. and the trout picks up the second one just because it gets tuned in, you know, the search mm-hmm. image kind of thing. Oh, ooh, bug. Oh, yeah, there's one. Bam, you know.
So yeah, I've heard that as well.
You know, so I think maybe that's what he was referring to. But.
Yeah, and I don't know, unless the flies would be identical, I don't know that it would do anything to reinforce their search image and maybe make them think that, wow, there's a lot of scuds in the water, let's start eating them. I don't know that it might have that kind of impact with only two flies present,
right?
Because I think there's more conditioning, I think, to really focus their attention on a food source. But it might. I don't really have the answer to that.
Okay. Okay, this is from Tim in Alameda. And this has happened to me down on the San Juan River, so I can totally relate to this. He says, Jason, last year on Hat Creek in the Carbon Flat section, I saw across the river a fish rising. He had a great lie under low branches with a sweeper below him. So I entered the water, crept up across the river slowly, which took 20 to 30 minutes. It got within 30 feet of him. Try as I might, I could not get a good drift after several casts, and I put him down. When I gave up and I looked down into the water, which is about 3.5 feet deep, there were three trout about 10 to 14 inches swimming around my boots. I do not understand why did the fly line bother the one fish, yet the casting and boot movement failed to scare these others away. And I know on the San Juan, they weren't 10 to 14 inches. They were more like 18 to 20 inches at 5 feet.
Isn't that frustrating?
Oh, yeah.
I've had that happen, too.
Oh, yeah.
But I think if we stand in one position for a while, we are actually creating a disruption to the current. You know, so I think fish may start to come up, you know, behind where we might be standing in order to get out of the current. But it's different. Yeah, I don't have a really good explanation. It does happen. I think a lot of it has to do with perceived threats and stuff like that. But, again, it's something that happens that I don't know. I wouldn't know the answer to that.
Well, and then in the San Juan, they call it the San Juan Shuffle. And it's actually illegal there to fish below a waiting fisherman.
Yeah.
In other words, you can't have your buddy out there shuffling up, basically stirring up the bottom and getting the bugs going, and then start fishing below them. It's, you know, so.
You know, I think that's
kind of like chumming. It's chumming, basically.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, in a fish that's in a very difficult to approach position, I like to swing some wet flies or soft hackles at them. I think that, you know, getting a dead drift to some locations is really, really hard. And I think in that situation, I like to swing something that I can animate at the same time. And I think sometimes you can entice. It's like Sawyer's induced take. You know, if you cast over towards a fish and you can animate it or lift that or draw that right across the nose of a trout right at his lie, I think sometimes you can get that fish to take a fly. There's some spots where, you know, you just sit there and scratch your head and wonder, how could I get a dead drift to this place? But sometimes I think we overlook the fact that we can swing something towards them and sometimes have some success as well.
Yeah, good
but
tip.
I think that something that appears really unnatural to trout will oftentimes put them down. But I've also had the opposite happen. I've had some fish where I've gotten so frustrated and changed flies so many times, and I've cast them. I finally end up just splashing these things down around them, and they still continue to feed indiscriminately, almost disdaining my attempt to catch them. So sometimes you can put them down with one cast, and sometimes you can go through your fly box changing flies, and they're still rising when you leave.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah. Well, that's part of the fun of the game, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Question came in, and before we go on to what trout here and smell and taste, and we're running out of time, so those will be shorter topics, I think. But John and I'm not sure, Vandalia? I'm not sure where that is. He wrote in, he says, this still has to do with sight, so that's why I'm throwing it in. Do you think it's beneficial to put prominent eyes on flies? And I think you kind of talked to this about the tiger eye effect. And I guess, I don't know if he's talking about eyes on, you know, invertebrates or minnows or what.
Well, I really think it does. If you look at underwater photos, you look how the eye tends to pop out at you. And I think that it's really, look at the Clouser minnow again and the eyes that are on that. I think that it's a very, very attractive feature to trout.
Okay.
So I like it. I like eyes on streamers, and I think if you can, and again, our flies are never exact duplications. They're more like abstract paintings. There's something to suggest the food item. You can never really get a photographic replica generally of it, but I think there's key features, and I think the eyes are a key feature that they really key in on.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, I know a lot of people have experimented with tying exact replicas, and have found that they don't work as well as some of the ones that are more...
True. And a lot of times, too, I've seen some beautiful flies that are very plastic-looking, and they look like
right.
a plastic toy floating in the river. They look beautiful, but they don't act natural. And I think they lack some of those key things that I think are very important to trout.
Okay, let's talk about hearing. Do trout hear the way we do?
Well, they do and they don't. Their ears are adapted to an entirely different world than ours. They give us the same type of information that they give the trout. But ours are, we have a very elaborate external feature to the ear that acts almost like a funnel to direct the pressure waves that we translate the sound to a drum that is like a drum on a snare, you know, that kind of vibrates and pulses, and that's how we detect sound. Where trout really don't have an elaborate external ear, you can hardly see them at all. They don't have an ear opening the way we do. They detect the features of sound that are transmitted through water, and it's highly adapted to an underwater world. And it really is based on the difference between transmissibility of sound in air and sound in water.
So I know you talk about how, you know, a swim bladder can help with their hearing.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about that?
Sure. There's really, you know, let's just maybe start with the differences between how sound is transmitted in air and water. Water is much less compressible than air. There's a lot more space in between individual molecules in air and in water. It's 5 times faster, the transmission of sound, because it's not as compressible. There's 2 features to the way sound waves are transmitted. There is pressure waves, which is what we rely on mostly in air. The pressure waves then are transmitted down our ear canal to the eardrum. But there's a second feature of sound transmission called particle motion. And where most of what we detect as sound is pressure. Underwater, you have both components of sound. There is some pressure, you know, waves that are transmitted underwater, and that usually accounts for the far field detection of sound, something that's over a longer range. Particle motion aspect of sound transmission, where the individual molecules collide with each other, that provides the trout what we call near field sound detection. And so it's the far field pressure waves that the swim bladder helps to amplify. So the swim bladder is like a resonating chamber, if you will, for these pressure types of waves, maybe a little fainter. So it amplifies the pressure waves and also broadens the scope of the trout's hearing. So it helps with sensitivity, improves sensitivity of their hearing, and broadens the scope and range of their acoustic range of hearing. And that is mostly for sounds that are transmitted from farther away. So it'd be like a footfall of an angler walking along the shore. That swim bladder would help amplify those vibrations that are transmitted in the water, and the trout would detect them in that way.
So are the trout actually sensing more vibrations than actually hearing a sound?
It's hard to distinguish one from the other.
Okay.
And so they've really started to call it mechanoreception, where they're actually, both of them are more or less mechanical waves, whether they're pressure or particle motion. And so it's kind of like, I don't know, did you ever go to a Led Zeppelin concert when you were a teenager?
Sure. A lot of albums. Never got to
okay.
go to a concert.
Or Iron Butterfly or some of those.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The bass was so strong that you could feel the vibration in your chest.
Yeah.
Okay, that's still sound. But you're picking up vibration.
Yeah. Well, you do that when a young guy drives down the road here by me and half a block away, and I can feel the vibration from his bass in his car.
You know? That's right. So. Or the Harley-Davidson guy or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But and so really what that's doing is those vibrations are kind of more or less resonating in the hollow cavity of your chest. Mm-hmm. And so the swim bladder kind of does the same thing. So sound and vibration are, I think, are much more similar underwater than they are above water because of the transmissibility and the compressibility of the two mediums. So I think sound and vibration are harder to distinguish underwater than they are above water, and that's where the lateral line, oftentimes it's been misunderstood. It's been said to be like an antenna or a remote sense of touch or something like that, or part of the sense of hearing. And really it is all of those things and more or less none of those things. It's just another way of detecting these mechanical waves underwater. And so it's like the hairs on your arm. If you feel a breeze, you can feel sometimes that breeze on the hairs of your arm. It's just kind of the same thing. It's another way of detecting these types of mechanical waves underwater.
What waves do you think they're most, from a fly fisher standpoint, I would assume there's certain waves that they're used to feeling, for instance, in riffles or something. There's got to be a lot of vibration and stuff going on that they just
background
kind of
clutter.
Clutter. Yeah, white noise kind of thing.
Exactly. I think there is.
And then in other places, if we're wading into a, deep, quiet pool, it's got to play a different role. Does just logic prevail there and just, the quieter things are, the more careful you are?
I think that's probably true. I think it is. I think it also applies to vision, too. I mean, in that still pool, they can see you pretty uninterruptedly through the window to above, but when they're in a whitewater run where the water's really, turbulent and there's a lot of air entrained in the water, it becomes very opaque. I think that serves as a natural camouflage. So I think both from a visual standpoint and a sound standpoint, there is kind of a natural camouflage to fast-moving water. I think fish are much more approachable when they're in faster-moving water. I think the hardest fish to approach is that still water fish where you're trying to cast a midge to it, and the light fly hits the water and the ripple sends all those fish scattered. I think fish are much more wary in those types of situations. Like you described the still pool, I think you're going to be more likely to spook those fish.
Sure. Well, let's talk about trout smell and taste here. close things out. So how does the trout smell and taste work, and is it different than the way we smell and taste?
It's one of those situations, too, where I think the distinction for trout, anyway, between taste and smell are much more blurry than they are for us. But even for us, they are. Our sense of taste and smell are very much similar. I mean, they talk about the aromas of wines and things like that as a huge contribution to the flavor that we perceive, and how much a role our sense of smell how large a role our sense of smell plays in the food that we taste. And I think it's even more, combined, the two senses are more or less combined for trout. They don't have a nose that inhales water the way our nose inhales air. And, you know, there's no combined passageway between the mouth and the nose and the nostrils the way it is in people. Their olfactory organ is kind of an in-current, ex-current type of an affair. The water comes in. It flows over the bed of receptors and flows right back out through a separate opening. It doesn't get back into the back of the throat. So, you know, I think, again, their senses are, the sense of smell and sense of taste are very similar. I think the best distinction that I've read about the difference that the sense of smell for trout is more linked to the communication system, you know, where there's chemical messengers sent through the water, especially in the form of pheromones for spawning behaviors and those types of things. I think the sense of smell is more involved in that, and the sense of taste is more regulates food uptake. So once they get something in the mouth, if it tastes appropriate, then they're more likely to swallow it.
And I suppose some fish are different than others. It's just like sculpin without the swim bladder. If you think about, you know, power bait and catfish, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember my grandfather fishing with garlic marshmallows, you know.
Yeah.
Downing one himself, you know. So.
Oh, yeah.
So there's got to be some fish that are more attuned to smell.
There are. Yeah, you look at the catfish as a perfect example. I mean, they've got these long barbels that have chemical receptors on the end of their whiskers, more or less, and some fish can actually kind of, you know, sift through the silty material on the bottom in very low light conditions and just kind of churn up stuff and be able to pick out food particles from that the material. Yeah, I think that plays a real role. I think there's a big difference. Trout also have some surface chemical receptors that are aligning on the face and around the gill plates that also are more or less a superficial chemical receptor that helps in the sense of smell or taste.
Mark, who's down in New Zealand, wrote in. He says, "What sort of substances can a trout smell, or can they smell the natural materials we use in fly tying, for instance? And if so, which ones?" I know a lot of people put a lot into, you know, like the chemicals and the glues and stuff we use.
Yeah, and some of that stuff I'm sure does have a repellent effect, and I think there's some commonly recognized ones like sunscreen and bug spray are probably some of the ones that are the most notorious. Fish generally are able to pick up amino acids and bile acids and things like that. They can actually recognize their kin or conspecifics, feather fish that they're related to. And just much like a dog will sniff, you know, the feces or the anus of another dog, and they can get some very individual aromas from that in the form of bile acids.
Yeah, for sure,
to say the least.
Yeah.
But I do think that trout, you know, they also have that ability, and they also have the ability to detect alarm substances. So if there's a large prey fish that's feeding just upstream and it bites into a small trout fry, those materials that are released in the consumption of that small trout are released into the water, and they alert other trout. So there's a lot of alarm cues that I think go into it. So I think that is also the basis of some fish attractants, too, is that there are certain things that are triggers. So there's a lot of research right now going on in that specific area.
Aaron in Erie, Colorado asked specifically, can trout smell cigarettes on your fly? Smoke, I guess, is what he's, or the leader, or in the air.
Well, in the air, I don't think that the the likelihood is as great as as picking up aromas from the air and transferring them into the water. I think that's probably less likely, but I think that they are certainly able to detect the things that are transmitted from our fingers and hands onto our flies and leaders. But then I've seen, I've fished with fishing guides and people, other fishermen that are chewing tobacco and spit right into the water, and it doesn't seem to really have an effect. I think. I think we need to be careful of some of the odors and the scents that we transmit to our flies and leaders. I think there are certain things that are really deleterious. I do think that tobacco and nicotine and some of those things are probably offensive.
There's not
been a lot of controlled studies on that. A lot of that is going to be anecdotal.
So, Aaron, what you need to do is just tell your friend, since I know it's not you smoking the cigarettes, tell your friend to quit smoking, and then you don't have the problem anymore. So.
Well, I think it's probably cheap cigars. If they would upgrade to the $5 cigars, they probably would have better cigars.
Catch more fish, huh?
Yeah. If not, they'd probably enjoy it more.
Okay, so, and I think we probably just address this. Mark says, what if I just had lunch and tie on a fly? Does the odor from my fingers affect the fly much that I would get a refusal in my future? And I think we just kind of addressed that.
I think it goes back to the search image again, too. And I think that there are certain things that, I think would be something that would alert the trout, to the undesirability of a certain food rather than taking that. So I do think, I actually tried, there was a study that showed that there's a chemical in the skins of flathead minnows that attract the predator activity of like large trout and things like that, that if they get the scent of this, that there's feeding opportunities available for them. So I actually I went over to the local bait store. I bribed some flathead minnows out of the owner, who I know pretty well. And I went home and I skinned them on our kitchen counter. And I ground them up into a slurry, and I dipped my flies in them just to see what effect it would have. And by the end of the day, I didn't catch any more fish than anybody else did. And but I was kind of the object of ridicule and all the jokes.
I guess.
Yeah. But it didn't really do anything. But there certainly is. Yeah, I think, again, it goes back to the basis of fish attractants and stuff like that. But I think the interesting thing about that search image is that, trout are actually looking for a reason to bite our fly. And they're looking for a reason to accept this prey species. They need to feed. I mean, feeding is a biological need. They need to satisfy that need for food. And so they're really looking for a checklist. It's a positive list, not a negative list. If they were looking for a reason to refuse our fly, the hook would be the most obvious detractant. I mean, they'd see the hook and they would say, that's not anything edible. They're actually looking for yes, this is there, yes, this is there. Yes, this is also there. Yes, I'll eat it. So that's kind of their checklist. It's not looking for a reason to refuse the fly. They're looking for a reason to eat it.
Yeah, and I think, too, it depends on the environment as well. If we're dealing with flies passing a trout by in a riffle, they don't have a lot of time to make a decision. Now, if they're in a quiet pool and they can swim up and look it over and check all the angles and
it's much more leisurely.
That's a different story. But when that thing's going by at 30 miles an hour, you've got to make a decision quickly.
And sometimes, the scent, obviously they don't scent anything from downstream of their position. So scents are carried, in the currents as well. And so I think sometimes scents might, something that's noxious as a smell on our fly might account for some close range refusals.
Yeah.
Sometimes it might be the color as well.
Yeah.
So if you're getting a lot of close-range refusals, I think what I would look at is not the size and shape of the fly. I would look at the color or maybe a scent that's on it, because that usually would account for that they're kind of at that point gotten through most of that checklist and they're thinking, yes, I'm going to try to eat this. Maybe, oh, there's something about it, and then they pass on it. So those close-range refusals, think about color. Maybe the color's off a little bit. Maybe there is a scent on it.
Yeah, yeah. I remember we did an interview with Ralph Cutter, and I don't know if you know Ralph, but he wrote a book called Fish Food.
Mm-hmm.
And
I
remember, pardon?
I've read his book.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I remember in that conversation he was talking about his underwater research that he did, that he was just amazed at how much stuff trout take in.
Yeah.
Sticks, rocks, you know.
Mm-hmm. Cigarette butts.
Yeah, you know, it says, you know, they're tasting all kinds of stuff. He says, usually it's not a problem of getting stuff in the trout's mouth. It's more of a problem of sensing and getting the strike, you know.
Right.
Getting the hookup. And that's more our problem than, you know, getting the stuff into their mouth. And he says, we just miss way more opportunities than we know about. And,
yes, entirely true. Yeah, with underwater videos and things like that we have shot as part of our research, the first book actually addresses that, Moving Water, A Fly Fisher's Guide to Currents, how many strikes we've recorded underwater that are not detected by the angler, and a lot of it has to do with the inaccuracy of most of our strike detectors. We now feel that we probably miss more strikes than we actually detect.
Yeah, yeah, that's, I think, the general consensus, yeah. Well, that's we've about run out of time here, Jason. I need to take a quick break, but let's everybody stick around, because when you come back, we're going to be giving away the membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, the one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and, of course, Jason's book, Trout Sense, so courtesy of Stackpole Books. So stick around for just a few more minutes, and we'll see if we can't win some of these contests and prizes. A mining company called Pack Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project could be the first project in Alaskan history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pack Rim says it can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts find no example of where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna coal strip mine, and if you'd like to see how you can help and find out more information, go to www.chewitna.org, and that's spelled C-H-U-I-T-N-A, Chewitna, Chewitna.org, and you can see how you can help with that project. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our show on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away some prizes. So the first thing we're going to give away, first two things are random drawings from our show's registration database. So if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do for the next show. And that way you have a good chance of winning one of these great prizes. So the first thing we're giving away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and which is a great organization to participate in. It's international, covers salt, warm water, and cold water, so you can't miss. And if you want to check them out, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. And our winner for that is Anthony Scotto in California. So, Anthony, congratulations on winning that one-year membership. If you do already have a membership, we can get that extended for you. So enjoy and congratulations. The second thing we're going to give away is Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, one-year subscription, courtesy of Amato Books, a great source for all kinds of books and publications around fishing. And our winner for that is... Let's see here. Come on, computer. Ellen Murphy in Minnesota. So Ellen Murphy in Minnesota. So congratulations, Ellen. and we'll get that subscription started for you. If you did, both Anthony and Ellen, I'll contact you by email to get your information so that we can get your memberships and subscriptions started. So look for that email from me. Okay, now, giveaway, Jason's book. And, Jason, you got to help me out on this. Make sure I get the right answer I'm looking for here.
Okay.
And we're going to give away Jason's book, Trout Sense, courtesy of Stackpole Books, and a great book to learn more about what trout sense, and, of course, all that will make you a better fly fisher for sure. So, and we just kind of touched the surface tonight. That's based upon previewing Jason's book, we just touched the surface, so you'll have plenty more to learn. All right, so I'm going to ask you a question, and the first person answered correctly, and you need to also put in your name and where you're from in the text box on our homepage. So somebody had written in about some confusion about that. The text box on our homepage, right under the section for Jason's show, that's where you put in your answer. Okay? So the, let's see. Okay, we got some thanks to you from Lanford and Castle Rock, so kudos to you, Jason, on tonight's show.
Oh, thank you.
And, okay, so I got my cue cleared here, and the question is, we talked a lot about search image. So in order of preference, what did Jason say were most important for the search image? One, two, and three. Give me the three things in order, and then you win Jason's book. Okay, so... what is the order of preference for the search image? Okay, we'll see who's listening out there, Jason.
Okay.
Because you said that only once or twice, but kind of stuck with me, especially you giving the example of the cars and so forth. So I'm refreshing here, looking for an answer. Okay. We've got Doug up in Canada, and he's the first one that's produced an answer, and he says size, Doug McLean, size, shape, and color. And I think that's it, isn't it?
That's correct, yep. And animation is the fourth, but those are the three main ones.
Right, size, shape, and color. So congratulations, Doug. You were first, and you were right. So you win Jason's book, Trout Sense.
Oh, I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, yeah. Congratulations, Doug, and thanks for paying attention.
Don't try to read it in one sitting, though.
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah, it's a lot of information, and you can see how much work Jason put into it. When you get it, you'll be impressed. So, Doug, send me your address so that we can get Stackpole to send this out to you directly from their publishing facility. So you can do it right in the same box that you sent the answer in, or you can send it to Roger at askaboutflyfishing.com. So thanks for playing, and those others, yeah, there's some other good answers here, but you were a little late, so better luck next time, but thanks for playing. Well, Jason, thanks so much for being on the show again tonight. Really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, and so thanks for taking your time to spend with us. Hopefully, if you're new to Ask About Fly Fishing, be sure to check out our archive on our website. We've got close to 200 shows there. I think we're at 197 or 198 right now. So a ton of just incredible information from incredible fly fishers around the world. Check it out. Do your searches. Use keyword phrases like trout or tarpon or trout senses or whatever, and you'll come up with all kinds of shows to go experience. So check it out. Our next broadcast will be on October 1st, and on that show I'm going to interview Deke Meyer, and the topic for the show will be fly fishing inflatables. So fly fishing from inflatables. Deke wrote the book on fly fishing from float tubes and inflatables, and but that's just the beginning. We're going to have, today we have many different personal crafts to choose from, and Deke's going to school us in the differences between them and, more importantly, how to use them most effectively to catch more trout and bass and other species. So join us for that show. I'm sure you'll have a great time listening to Deke. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Stackpole Books, Platte River Fly Shop, Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company, and Front Range Anglers for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, just give us a call at 1-800-985-1673. and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. That's 1-800-985-1673. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.